Pakistanis have been presenting militants in Afghanistan with a safe haven, training, money, everything else.
The United States urges Pakistan to redouble efforts against terrorism. It's Wednesday, December 6th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China steering the way for electric cars, Beijing forcing out migrant workers, democracy under siege in Macau, business scene, and smell technology. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis made a one-day visit to Pakistan to urge both civilian and military leaders to redouble efforts to keep insurgents from using the country as a base from which to attack Afghan and international forces in neighboring Afghanistan. The Defense Department said Mattis recognized Pakistan's sacrifices in the war on terrorism and emphasized the vital role Pakistan can play in working with the United States and others to facilitate a peace process in Afghanistan that brings stability and security to the region. The visit followed the August announcement of a new Trump administration South Asia policy that, among other things, demanded Pakistan crack down on terrorist safe havens. But Nazif Shahrani, who chairs the Near Eastern Languages and Cultures Department at Indiana University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, if anything, the situation has gotten worse.
The fact is, inside Afghanistan, there is absolutely no evidence of any change. Not only that, if the change is, the change is for the worse. In the last 3-4 days in Jalalabad, the closest city to Pakistan-Burhan border, there have been essentially massacre going on, 2-3 bombs a day. And most of these are probably Haqqani network people. So I'm not quite sure what the progress is. It would have been nice if Secretary Mattis told us what that change or development or positive thing may have been.
There is a new Trump administration South Asia policy that was released in August, and one analyst suggested that the volatile partnership is now in a precarious state, thanks in large part to that strategy, which, according to this analyst, infuriated Islamabad with strongly worded demand that Pakistan crack down on terror safe havens and its explicit call for India to step up its role in Afghanistan. Does Pakistan have grounds to be upset?
Well, Pakistanis give themselves the right to be upset. They really think that Afghanistan should be one of their provinces and do as they wish. And that's not going to happen. And not only that, they don't want Afghanistan to have much to do with India because of their own animosities and because of their own conflicts over Kashmir. But this is a total absurdity. So they have given themselves the right, I suppose, to be upset because the current Trump administration has been improving United States relationship with India. And maybe that they think is a kind of a leverage, but obviously Pakistanis don't see that as leverage because they have done nothing to change their behavior. And they may be searching other alternatives for aid and other sorts of relationships to sort of slap the United States in the face.
The defense chief met not just with civilian authorities, but military authorities, including the head of the Inter-Services Intelligence Spy Agency that U.S. officials say has links with the Haqqani network and Taliban militants. Is Pakistan a key to ending the fighting in Afghanistan?
Absolutely. I mean, we have historically good evidence that these kinds of guerrilla warfare does not end until the safe haven, a secure place from which they lodge their attacks, disappears. And Pakistanis have been presenting militants in Afghanistan with Haqqani group or Taliban a safe haven, training, money, everything else. So they have a safe place from which they operate on a daily basis, and what happens in Jalalabad or in Kabul or a lot of other cities in Afghanistan could not happen if these militants did not have a safe and secure place to return to or to operate from.
Woodrow Wilson Center South Asia expert Michael Kugelman said Trump administration officials have suggested they could implement unprecedented measures if Pakistan does not act forcefully, including expanded drone strikes and targeted sanctions against Pakistani officials with ties to terrorists. He described U.S.-Pakistani relations as a volatile partnership that is in a precarious state. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Philippine police ordered back to front lines of bloody anti-drug crackdown. UN official begins rare diplomatic mission to North Korea. Two former spy chiefs charged with bribery of former South Korea leader. Women in Delhi slum use Indian Information Act to access water. Protected but stifled, a Pakistani minority feels imprisoned in its own community. Expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also find them at the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The future of electric cars can be found in China. That's the opinion of the man who heads the U.S.-based Ford Motor Company. The New York Times reported Tuesday from Shanghai that William C. Ford Jr., the executive chairman of Ford, said when you think of where EVs, meaning electric vehicles, it's clearly the case that China will lead the world in EV development. Ford said his company planned to introduce 15 battery electric or plug-in gasoline electric hybrid cars in China by the year 2025. David Cole is a well-known and respected authority on automotive industry trends. He founded and heads the Auto Harvest Organization and serves as chairman of the board emeritus of the Center for Automotive Research. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Dr. Cole if he was surprised at the statements of the Ford chairman.
I'm really not surprised. I know Bill Ford quite well. Bill is thinking about the future, very focused on the longer-term trends and making sure that the Ford Motor Company is going to be a part of that future. And when you look at China, to begin with, you have to realize that the sales of autos and trucks and everything in China is significantly greater than it is here in the U.S. It's the world's number one market. Secondly, they have some really tough problems in some of their cities with pollution. It's a huge issue. And basically the government, which is a one-party government, has decided that one of the things that they need to do is to really emphasize the development and production and sale of electric vehicles. And already a number of the domestic companies, as well as partnerships with companies from other parts of the world, are producing both pure electrics and hybrid vehicles in China. But it's a very important market, and I think it's a trend that we'll see probably in other places of the world fairly soon.
Does that include the United States?
Well, I think the United States is in a little different situation because of relatively low-cost fuel. There's not as much general interest in electrification. We don't have really the pollution problems. But, for example, a number of countries in Europe have said that by 2040 it's only going to be electric vehicles. And so the trend is evident. Now the challenge is stepping up in terms of the cost, the technology. And one of the big issues, and probably the pivotal issue in terms of the future of electrification, is the battery. When you compare the energy content in terms of the space used, a battery is very inefficient compared to gasoline, for example. And we've got to get the cost down to a reasonable number. It's a very exciting trend in the industry, and it's also very exciting because there are so many other factors that are we're dealing with today, whether it's autonomous vehicles or the concept of mobility, and a problem that is existing all over the world. It's not unique here, and in fact, it's worse in many places, is the availability of appropriately educated talent. Engineers, technicians, skilled trades people, business people. So this is just one of the big issues, but it's a very important one.
China seems to be jumping ahead of other countries, including the United States. When you and I visited with each other a number of years ago in Ann Arbor and in Detroit, we talked about many Chinese companies either buying up auto parts companies in the United States, in the Michigan area, and also sending people to be trained. Have they indeed continued that? And obviously something's working.
Absolutely. In fact, what we're looking at in the world today is a world of vanishing boundaries. The auto technology, the development of vehicles. It's in a world without boundaries. It's not just here. It's really everywhere. While the Detroit area is still a very central focus of product development, there are other parts of the world that are like that now or becoming like that.
Does this have any political implications between the United States and China as you see it, or you don't want to get involved in it?
I think we have to face the fact that politics are everywhere. And one of the things that we're facing here in just the U.S., for example, in autos, we've got uncertainty on the powertrain and what mobility and autonomy and all of these things are. Then you have to layer on the policy impacts. And with Trump, you know, it could be regulations, it could be tax policy, immigration policy. And this is true everywhere in the world. We cannot look at such an important factor as electrification without being deeply interested and concerned in terms of how the political world is going to fit into that.
Dr. David Cole is a respected authority on automotive industry trends. He founded and now heads the Auto Harvest Organization. And obviously, from what we just heard and what he just said, he has a job lying ahead of him for many years to come. And he serves as chairman of the Board Emeritus of the Center for Automotive Research. David, thanks so much for being with us. It's great to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you as well, and best wishes. There's going to be a lot of stories about this over the next few months and few years.
Happening now in Asia, a high-ranking United Nations official is on his way to North Korea to help lower tensions over the secretive regime's nuclear and ballistic missile testing programs. Jeffrey Feltman's visit comes less than a week after Pyongyang announced it had successfully test-fired a new intercontinental ballistic missile. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. Authorities in the Chinese capital Beijing have launched a sweeping campaign that is forcing tens of thousands of migrant workers out of their residences and out of the city. The government says the effort was initiated for public safety. VOA's Bill Ide and Yue Bing recently visited some villages that have been caught up in the campaign.
Little remains of what used to be Xinjian Village, where a fire last month killed 19 people. It is now ground zero for a campaign that has spread and affected tens of thousands of lives across the city, as authorities crack down on fire safety hazards. In some cases, residents have been evicted at a moment's notice. And many, like the owner of this restaurant, packed up and went home, says this employee who stayed behind. And it is not just opportunities they have been forced to part with, but investments as well.
There is another shop over there that just opened up a year ago. The owner invested more than $36,000, and now it has been torn down. Who knows if they will receive any compensation?
In another village across town, all ground-level shops have been shuttered. Local security guards were out patrolling the streets. The owners of this small restaurant plan to return to China's northeastern province of Heilongjiang.
There's no place to eat. You can't cook any food, and the heat has been turned off where we live. You can't use coal for fuel or gas or electricity, and there's no way to cook food.
Outside one newer complex, residents wait to get back their rental down payments. Around the corner, others load up a truck. With so many looking for a new place to live, at the same time, finding a new home is not easy. This man spent several hundred dollars just driving around and eventually settled on a farm outside the city for about $220 a month.
I'm not talking about a place where rich people live, just a place that has a shower, is warm, and where I can cook food and eat. That's enough.
Some believe authorities are forcing residents to pack up and leave just because they are what state media has previously described as Beijing's low-end population.
How do you define a low-end population? We are all Chinese citizens. What is low-end or high-end? It isn't something that you can define by the amount of money a person
has. The government denies that is the case and has censored the phrase online. But for many, the message the campaign is sending is still clear. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown.
Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on The Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has ordered the country's police force to resume their role in his sweeping crackdown on illicit drugs, citing a resurgence in illegal drugs in the Pacific archipelago. Duterte launched the campaign shortly after he took office in 2016 on a pledge to wipe out illicit drugs within 6 months. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for the latest. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. The Chinese island of Macau, the world's top gambling hub, is grappling with an unusual political crisis brought on by the suspension of Young Democracy parliamentarian Sulu Su, the first action of its kind since the island was turned over to China by Portugal. Su, elected in September, has been under investigation for aggravated disobedience following a protest last year against the transfer of $15 million from the Macau Foundation charity to a Chinese university on whose board Macau's chief executive sits. Su's trial date has not been announced, but the 26-year-old has been stripped of his duties by the island's assembly and can only return if found not guilty or sentenced to less than 30 days in jail. The case has raised concerns that a suppression of civil rights is taking place, the same concerns that exist in Hong Kong. Jorge Menezes is a Macau lawyer who has lived there since 1997. He tells VOA the issue is at stake is larger than just the criminal offense Su has been charged with.
What this was all about, I think, was the fact that there was, for the first time, a very strong voice in the Macau parliament, supported by youngsters. Thousands of youngsters have been supporting him. And he was demanding accountability in the Legislative Assembly. He was requiring transparency, and he was not fighting for personal interests. He is young. They are a group of people that they are fighting for values, and that made everyone very uncomfortable here. Very powerful people want to keep their food coming and so on. Everyone is quite upset because there is no reason for someone to suspend a member of the parliament as they did. Now, he was elected for sticking to positions as protesting on the streets. That's why people voted for him. So suspending him because of that is absolutely ridiculous.
He doubts Sulu Su will face jail time and says he committed no crime, having secured prior authorization to hold a protest in delivering a letter to the island's chief executive. Menezes says the real story is the reaction of what he called the powerful on Macau, who fear what he described as fearless, young, and principled democracy activists like Sulu Su. This news alert from VOA Asia, South Korean prosecutors have formally charged two former spy chiefs who were arrested last month over suspicions they used their agency's funds to make illegal payments to former President Park Geun-hye. Park was removed from office and then arrested in March and is being tried on broad corruption charges. Stop by VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, business is looking up after a year of economic turmoil in India, and a volcano disrupts tourism in Bali. These are the stories VOA Asia's Skylar Ogden has on today's business scene.
After a prolonged spell of relatively sluggish growth, profits are looking up for businesses in India. Recent data show GDP grew by 6.3% in the July-September quarter. Although it's more than 1% lower from a year ago, it halts a five-quarter slide. India's finance minister, Arun Jaitley.
The last five quarters had witnessed a downward trend. This marks the reversal of that trend.
Analysts say the downward trend was due in part to a goods and services tax launched by Prime Minister Narendra Modi in late June. The nationwide sales tax replaced myriad business taxes that varied from state to state and attempted to unify the system under a single market. Aside from the tax overhaul, Modi had also sent shockwaves through the streets when he banned the country's largest currency bills in late 2016 in an attempt to curb corruption. The ban effectively removed 80% of the currency in circulation.
Perhaps the impact of two very significant structural reforms, demonetization and the GST, is now behind us. And hopefully in the coming quarters, we can look for an upwards trajectory.
Earnings for major Indian companies rose at their best pace in six quarters during the July-September quarter, and continued profits are expected in the current quarter. The hospitality industry in Bali, Indonesia, is still struggling as the Mount Agung volcano continues to rumble after its eruption on November 28th. These days, the only thing that's really active is the ash and steam spewing out of Mount Agung. Surfboard rental vendor Demi Sehen.
Usually we can earn about 60 to 74 U.S. dollars from surfboard rental and can collect a profit of up to $29 every day. But now, it is considered good business if we earn about half of it.
After the volcano's eruption, the government ordered residents to evacuate every village within 10 kilometers of the volcano, turning previous tourism hotspots into near ghost towns. The worst of it came when Bali closed its international airport for about 3 days last week, stranding many tourists on the island and prompting others to cancel their upcoming trips. Tut Tunis is the manager of Panorama Cottages.
Since the eruption of Mount Agung, there were some guest cancellations, but it became worse after the airport closure. Almost 90% of the guests canceled their bookings.
While Indonesia's disaster mitigation agency says most of Bali is now safe for tourists, many local businesses expect to take a hit during year-end holidays. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
Would you buy a car that sprayed soothing aromas when you're stuck in rush hour traffic? Or how about a robot that has the scent of a real person? Well, scientists say that new technology means we will soon be using devices like these in our everyday lives. Henry Ridgewell visited the British Science Festival in Brighton, England to find out more.
Virtual reality with an added dimension. Scientists from Britain's University of Sussex have developed virtual worlds that even smell like the real thing. When users open a virtual door, in this case into a rainforest, diffusers spray the appropriate scent for added authenticity.
It is a really immersive experience that you have because you're exploring this environment and you have smells that correspond with it.
Smell technology has been tried before, memorably with Smell-O-Vision movies in the 1960s. These scientists say it's on the cusp of a comeback.
The connection with emotion, memories, and the potential to use the sense of smell, the odors under the threshold, under the awareness, is incredible what we can do with technology.
And not just for entertainment. Here, a driving simulator has been fitted with a scent diffuser.
In this demo, we wanted to deliver the smell of lavender every time the driver exceeds the speed. We chose lavender because it's a very calming smell.
Mobile phones could also send alerts using odors. Businesses are already experimenting with using scent to influence customers' behavior.
Not only for marketing in stores, so creating the logo brand, but in the other side you can create and stimulate impulse buying. So you're in a library, you smell coffee, and then actually you are unconscious, but you are suddenly having the need to drink a coffee.
Maggioni says scent is vital in human interactions. For example, when men smell tears, levels of testosterone are reduced and they show more empathy. That physiological reaction can be applied to new technology.
In the interaction with robots, how we can build trust with a robot if the robots smell like us.
An exciting and perhaps for some daunting future. Scientists say the sense of smell, until now largely unexploited, is about to be stimulated by the march of technology. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Brighton, England.
Well, you haven't been able to smell it, but you've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can also find us streaming each and every day, VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. Also, both great places to get in touch with us. You can send us an email as well, voaasia@voanews.com. We're heard on the radio, like U Radio of Hatay University, FM 101.25. At Hatay University in Thailand, we thank everyone there who's listening to our program today. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Aydin Utku, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, David Bird, and Ira Melman on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington, and we wish you a great day ahead.